Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 21st of September. Very nice to have you with us. Starting off with a little Dropkick Murphys this morning, and I'm thrilled they're playing at Fresh Grass on Saturday night, which is going to be just terrific. I'm hoping to make it. I'm going to Buffalo. I'm going to go see Peter Gabriel. And then I got to get back from Buffalo to see Dropkick Murphys. And if that works and my wife lets me, I'll go. But more about my stamina, I think, than anything else. And then another weird thing coming up is that we have the opportunity to interview Ken Casey, who's the frontman for Dropkick Murphys, and I have that opportunity in about 15 minutes. So I'm going to slip out, talk to him. Sarah will come in. She'll take over for a few minutes, and then I'll go back and come back and finish up the show.
So are your hobbies taking over from your real job here, Joe?
Do well,
we
my
need
real
to
job,
check you on this?
Okay, my real job is
Where's
to do
human
interviews.
Resources?
Oh, I've seen them plenty this week. No, I have.
You don't have to explain to her.
No, what I was saying is that it's an interview that will air tomorrow. So it's it's part of work.
We'll let you.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I like Sarah.
We all do.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could just argue amongst ourselves while you're gone. I mean,
that'd be fine.
That would be no
too.
Problem.
That'd be fine too.
We might need a ref.
I don't think you're gonna. Yeah, I'll get you good and wound up. You'll just go at it, and you probably won't even notice I'm gone. Okay. So good morning, everybody. Welcome. We've got a great group here this morning, and we will get started. Let me introduce everybody to you. In alphabetical order, investigative reporter and visiting professor at UAlbany, Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
We also welcome public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning. Just delighted to be here.
Nice to
you. Beautiful day. Beautiful
it
day.
It is a beautiful day. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much, and happy 50th birthday to the United Tenants of Albany.
Well, nice. Yeah. 50 years old. Very cool. And we also welcome investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Joe.
Nice to have you here as always. Thank you very much for being here. You can join us by emailing us at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Does anybody have a preference of stories you'd like to start off with this morning? There's three possible stories that we could start off with this morning. Does anybody have a preference?
Well, I just saw that McCarthy is not going to meet with Zelensky today and have a forum. So I just want to say for a moment how despicable that is.
Oh, you're right.
Speaker McCarthy has announced that Ukrainian President Zelensky's in town today.
Yes.
In Washington, D.C. And he was supposed to host a forum with Republicans because of their concerns. And I just see a story that he's now
I'm
not
sure
even
going to
host
I'm sure he's off busy taking care of the looming budget government shutdown crisis.
If only that were the case. If only that. Any case. So now what story do you?
That wasn't on the list.
Yeah, let's go to
Tuberville.
Do the Zelensky thing. Don't you love the fact that one man is leading his country into battle against what was the world's, say, third largest military? And the other man can't even muster the political courage to have a meeting.
To meet with him. It's so stunning. That's exactly what I was thinking. This man is leading his country in a way that surprises everyone. You know, he didn't come to this with a political background. What is he, a comedian? And he's done incredible things. His people are sacrificing. They're devoted to him. They're devoted to their country. He is doing this not only for the Ukraine, but for the world, trying to sustain some sort of democracy in the world and not a march, holding back Putin. And House Speaker, Republican House Speaker McCarthy cannot take time to meet with him because his far right won't like it. I mean, that is just hideous.
Facing a right-wing rebellion in his ranks and mounting GOP resistance to aiding Ukraine has declined to convene a forum for President Volodymyr Zelensky to address members of the House today during a visit to Capitol Hill. While Mr. McCarthy is expected to meet with Mr. Zelensky privately, his decision not to host a meeting where the Ukrainian president could make a direct appeal to rank-and-file lawmakers underscores the deep Republican divisions over continued U.S. assistance for Kyiv's fight against the Russian invasion. It also reflects McCarthy's own precarious position as he draws ire from the right wing over federal spending and stepped-up threats to oust him if he does not embrace his members' priorities, which include cutting off money to Ukraine. The situation stands in contrast to the reception that Mr. Zelensky is receiving in the Senate, where Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, and the majority leader has organized a closed-door session in the Capitol for all 100 senators.
Right. To his credit, Senator Mitch McConnell feels it's very important, right, that they meet and they hear from him. And what signal does this send around the world?
It says Republicans are sick of paying for the war and they're not going to do it anymore, which we already know.
No, not because Mitch McConnell's a Republican and he's meeting with
him. Mitch McConnell's power is in the dumpster right now.
Well, the Senate Republicans are meeting with him. I don't think
the whole Senate's meeting with him under Schumer's auspices.
Exactly. Right.
Now, you and I know that McConnell's view of our support for Ukraine differs from that of the far right berserker conference.
He
in the
made
House.
That clear yesterday.
Right.
I mean, I am no Mitch McConnell fan at all, but he does understand, you know, basic global issues and.
Well,
let's talk about
that. Dad would say, who my mom and dad are both military veterans, and as my dad would say, some of us remember when it was of critical importance to keep Russia at bay, and some people seem not to.
Right. And you got to wonder, is carrying Trump's water for him, you know, Trump is so pro-Putin. This is just hideous. Sorry, but we can switch to...
No, that's all right. Would you like the beef? Would you like the fish? Would you like the chicken? Would you like the vegetarian option? I'll have lasagna. Okay.
Vegetarian? I'm having vegetarian lasagna. But it's all intertwined. You know, let's go to Tuberville because it's all intertwined, right? Because what about our military readiness? Because it's intertwined with no budget. It's intertwined with holding up the military. Yeah, it's all...
I mean, $24 billion for additional military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine's war. And I think, you know, it is interesting to think of what that meeting would be like if it did happen, because it obviously would be tense, I would think, wouldn't it?
But as of last night, it was going to be a quote-unquote select group of leadership, House Republican leadership, some committee chairs and, you know, top, you know, Republicans who focus on defense issues and other things. And certainly the country does need a conversation about whether, you know, how long do you continue to fund this? I mean, that's democracy. That's part of it. But to not have a House Republican meeting with him is just, to me, disrespectful.
Let's go to as Teresa rightly says, these are intertwined, and so we'll start off. We already started off. But
yeah,
you
sorry,
know what
I kind of
no, that's all right. That's okay.
Hijacking
is fine.
Sorry, I looked at the headline and I lost my mind for a minute.
that is welcome. That's what we want that in our panelists. The Senate confirms Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff sidestepping Tuberville's blockade. The Senate backed General Charles Q. Brown Jr. of the Air Force for chairman, and planned to advance promotions of two other military officials blockaded by Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama. The vote was 83-11 and was expected to be followed by confirmations of the Marine Corps and Army chiefs, which also have been held up for months by Mr. Tuberville, an Alabama Republican, over the Defense Department's abortion access policies. General Brown is set to succeed Army General Mark Milley when he steps down as Joint Chiefs Chairman at the end of the month. The Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York worked around Mr. Tuberville's roadblock by bringing up each individual nomination for a full Senate vote. But hundreds more promotions remain in limbo over objections by Mr. Tuberville. So explain to me why this could not have been done a long time ago.
Because Tuberville was right. This was a maneuver by Democrats to make Republicans look bad.
No.
Yes. Let me have my say first, and then you can answer, okay? Because I know that the rest of the whole panel is going to say, Tuberville this, because I've been tisting too. And what he did is crappy. But it was not the crisis. Our whole armed forces was going to fall down, and national security was at risk. They could have done this months ago. And Tuberville is also right, that they could have done two or three appointments every day for a week. Schumer could have kept them home for their little August break and done all of them. This doesn't have to be a crisis. There was a way around it, which I wish I had known about. I did not. I hate that I'm just hearing that he had this this technique, and Tuberville was the one who announced it. Schumer's only doing it now because Tuberville was going to take credit for it. And the media, look at that. Look at what you just read. It's like, Schumer figured out a way around it. No, that's not even true.
Yeah.
The Tuberville is right. This was all drama by the Democrats. So there.
All right. Teresa, go.
Not true.
is.
Issue one.
I disagree. You can start off with that. Okay.
Thank you. I disagree. There is technically a way around it. It's been discussed for a long time, but it's not feasible. There are 316 of these, and every one you fill, then you have to fill the next one. And it takes 30 hours of debate, and at any point he could stop that. You logistically could not get all of these people confirmed and continue to get people confirmed in the way that you need to, doing it in this way, and continue to do the Senate business. Technically it works, but practically it does not. It does not work. And the only reason that they were able to do it in the shortened time that they did it yesterday is because when When Tuberville found out that he was going to have to stay for the weekend, he allowed the Schumer folks to shorten the time. He didn't require them to use all the time they normally would. But when you place a hold, yes, there is a way around it, but a way around 300 now are backlogged, and then every one of those you fill, then that creates another backlog. This is an ongoing process, and the military cannot function this way. They cannot function with all of these vacancies.
This is the same as the Democrats saying, the Republicans are completely blocking gun control. What they're doing is blocking a whole lot of it. They're being jerks, don't get me wrong. But the Democrats are doing nothing because they want all or nothing for political purposes. And that's exactly what
the issue resolved where it should be resolved, which is on the NDAA.
They leave it at nothing? They leave it with no gun control and, the military, we've got people screaming that
the Iranians are going to attack us. The problem here is not the Democrats. The problem here, and even the Republicans are beginning to say it, and that's why this move, because he met with his Republican caucus and they said, you cannot keep this up and not have a chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said he just found out last week that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had to retire legally, that he didn't understand. He said, Milley will stay around until this is resolved. Milley can't by law stay around, just like the head of the Navy, the top military leader of the Navy couldn't just stay around.
And that legal limit was there months ago when this began. Schumer could have done this. Why did he let the senators go home during August?
What's the underlying issue here, Rosemary?
The underlying issue is that this was not the way Democrats and the underlying issue is
a policy issue. A policy issue.
Oh, yeah, okay, policy.
What's the policy issue?
Abortion
is the policy issue. And allowing...
But that mixes it all up.
He has a hold, not because he has an objection. He doesn't have an objection to these nominations. He's using that as a tool because he wants to bring attention to his objection to allowing military members and their family to leave the state and have their transportation paid if they want to get You are absolutely care right. Out of
we
state,
know
which
this,
they
Teresa.
Already have that power.
We know
and
this,
the way
Teresa.
You fix that, the way you debate that, is a vote on the NDAA bill. It's a policy vote, and he is using this tool.
This is
that
why
has
the
never
Democrats are losing because they're thinking like you. We have to follow all the rules. The
yeah,
Republicans,
it's a democracy. You
no,
follow the rules.
No, the Republicans are not playing by those rules now. They're going. He found a loophole. Tuberville found a really great loophole to bring his issue to the forefront. And the Democrats always had the way around it and haven't used it until today.
But practically, you can't.
Oh, look,
not
Mark
time.
And Nick are here.
Sorry. Go ahead,
shut up. I'm done.
Sorry. I can't believe you're
oh, wow. We have two other panelists.
I'm not supporting him. I'm saying that he beat the Democrats and we were stupid to allow it.
They beat
That's
him
not
yesterday.
Supporting him.
Go ahead, Mark. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. Just I was the floor counsel and the second deputy counsel for the Senate majority, just disclosure. And I do think that there are, you know, it's a game of chess here. If you bring up individual appointments, there's unlimited time to debate those appointments. Democrats would be challenged on the abortion issue every single time for 300 appointments in unlimited debate. And it would give a window to the Republicans to face off on this particular issue. Like, that's what the GOP was trying to do, was to try to shed light on these abortion loopholes, as they think of them, for service members, and to target marginal members in the Democratic Party around their support of abortion, right? Like, it's not just, did we know there was loopholes? Of course people know they're not loopholes. They're just the rules. They're the Senate floor rules. They're not loopholes. That's just how it operates. And of course they knew that they could have always done this. But there's no loophole in the Senate rules that isn't part of a conversation.
How come the Republicans are the only ones to use this? How about the whole thing about the election denier was Trump's lawyers figuring out that, hey, we can use this ceremonial.
But what she's saying is actually the other problem is the Democrats, I mean, the Republicans did not
want... I hope you have
this
all worked out before I come back.
The Democrats did not want this debate because the Republicans actually do not want the policy vote because they don't want to take that abortion policy vote. That's part of
That's
the problem
true.
With McConnell's hands
yeah.
are tied
yeah.
because McConnell knew he could do this, but he is trying to protect his Republicans from having to take this vote because the public is not with the Republicans on this issue.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to Mark Whitman and we'll hear his thoughts on all of this. And then Sarah will be with us for a few minutes. So there'll be peace in the world and everything will be fine. And it'll all be worked out. And then we can talk about something.
I'm
very...
overcome by the smell of donuts.
Oh, my God. They're so good. we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. And we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. That is Sierra Farrell. She has a phenomenal new album out, I think this week, otherwise very, very recently or very soon. She's going to be at Fresh Grass at Mass Mocha this, I don't remember which day she's playing. So the festival, I'll just tell you, is Friday through Saturday, September 22nd through 24th. It's the Fresh Grass Festival at Mass Mocha. I'm Sarah LeDuc, filling in for a segment of the show this morning for Joe Donahue. I understand I've really walked into it, and I'm supposed to call on Mark. Mark.
Sarah, why did you wear a bulletproof vest when you walked in? That's the first question I have. But say, I have a view sort of in the middle here. The procedure that allows Tuberville to put a hold on these nominations is a nicety. It's not in our Constitution, for God's sake. Right. And it's a bit arcane that the Senate needs to approve a book of 300 names. So long run, you got to change that. The Democrats, I think Rosemary's right in the following sense. The Democrats wanted to make Tuberville look bad, so they walked around for weeks looking feckless and claiming that the sky was falling. They shouldn't have done either. They should have let him twist for a bit and look stupid, and then they should have got on with it. Because the problem the Democrats had is they were saying, this is bad for our national security. Well, you know what, Chuck Schumer? If something's bad for my national security and you can fix it, even if it requires having a cot in your office, I want you to fix it. I've worked 100-hour weeks. The yes. congressional estimate was 700 hours. That's 7 weeks of work, and you're done. Now, I understand Teresa's going to tell me there's a continual backlog. But you know what? You force the issue and make Tuberville look bad by solving it under the current constraint, and you put so much pressure on the Republicans that they all agree that maybe that the lieutenant general in charge of the Antarctic isn't somebody that we need to approve on an ongoing basis. Maybe we can trust and designate that authority elsewhere. So I think Tuberville's obviously what Tuberville has done that started this is abhorrent. By the way, Mitch McConnell's found it politically convenient, as he always does, to tuck in behind somebody else and just let them take the lead and the flack because he doesn't want the Senate to have to vote on this. And the Democrats have done what they too often do, which is run around ineffective and screaming about a problem that they actually can in large measure fix. That's where I come out on this.
Nick, what do you think?
I had my word before the break, but I think that really hits the nail on the head. I think both of those things are true. And, you know, as much as the Democrats try to capitalize on the opportunity, I think they could have done that in a shorter period of time and not allowed this to be drawn out. Like, the impact on, you know, military veterans was made, and then kind of that momentum was lost with the sort of drawn out discussion around the issue.
Rosemary?
No, I had my say.
Okay. All right, let's go to some letters. The email address is panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'll go to this one from, they already said that. Oh my goodness, everybody. Dana writes in and says, regarding Tuberville, disagree. You don't negotiate with terrorists.
Well, we do, actually, and we're getting people back from Iran and other places, too. We do negotiate. We ought to talk. You get nowhere if you don't talk.
Clarence writes into panel@wamc.org, says, I've clearly missed the explanation. What rule allows one senator to stop any senatorial process? How did this happen? Can we explain that?
Yeah, you have to have unanimous consent to schedule the joint hearing, and then the appointments get moved out of that committee to the floor for a vote. So there's like this unanimous consent moment to even move the appointments through committee to the floor. There's also unlimited debate time on appointments, I believe. So there's sort of an additional opportunity to sort of filibuster appointments in that way as well.
But the key is that any senator can put what they call a hold on nominations. And oftentimes when you put a hold, it's because you object to the person being nominated. In this case, Tuberville took the very unusual step of saying that he wasn't concerned about the nominees, about their qualifications for the position, but he wants the Secretary of Defense to change the provision that allows members of the military and their family in states that do not provide abortion health care to go out of state for that care and have that travel reimbursed and have the time off allowed. So if you have a military person or a person's spouse who has a, you know, dangerous pregnancy, for instance, and needs to go to a different state because they are not going to be able to bring their pregnancy to term and they can't, say they're in Texas or whatever, they can't, then the military would give that person time off and pay for their travel. And he objects to that, and rather than deal with that policy issue through the legislative process, he's dealing with it by using this tradition in the Senate of a nominee hold. Yeah, and the way to get around a nominal hold, as she says, is that you these are brought up by what's called unanimous consent. So if one person, anybody can stop it. So if one person objects
that
to unanimous
hold,
consent,
right.
That de facto is a hold. And the way to stop that is that you are allowed to filibuster 30 hours or more of debate. And so you'd have to debate each one of these for at least 30 hours and then have a vote. Mitch McConnell didn't want his Republicans to have to vote on this abortion issue. And so they stopped.
I have a question. Isn't the Pentagon policy to assist or allow somebody to take time off and reimburse for travel expenses, isn't that not just between states, but also if people are stationed abroad? I think it's both. Right.
I don't know if it's, I don't know the answer to that.
So
maybe.
There are, you know,
I do
some
know
stations
that they've had
and
this...
countries that have even more restriction on abortion than the most restrictive states in the United States. And I think the policy applies at any installation.
Right.
And that is part of the Pentagon's like interest in keeping the policy available. Also, I think it's noteworthy that a senator whose, you know, professional background is as a football coach wants to have this level of input in Pentagon policy around healthcare and its service members, and not just the service members, but the families of the service members.
Yeah, I just haven't read the language that carefully, so I don't know about the international issue. It makes sense, but I just don't know.
Increasingly, but, it's easier to get an abortion overseas than in America, including Ireland and Catholic countries in South America. So that may
but
be
it may have been in
we
place.
We have installations in
right.
Yeah,
I mean,
know, it's
every
like
region.
East
so
Africa,
yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
but I do know that they
which
had,
is another issue.
Yeah,
they,
yeah.
We're
yeah.
And it may have already been in place for those other countries. I just don't know. But I do know that they have had similar provisions that allow for travel to other places for other types of health care. I mean, this is not the fact that you get paid, you know, get time off and pay to travel to a different place to get the required health care. It has been in place in the Defense Department for a while. They just extended it post the loss of, you know, the Roe versus Wade being overturned, they extended it to abortion care. Mm-hmm.
I have one thing to say, Nick. I understand when people want to talk about Tuberville, they add in the fact that he was a football coach. But I do really think we need to be careful. I think we should judge him and everyone else with respect to their oversight of certain issues based on their actions, performance, and words, as opposed to what they might or might not have done. I took a myriad of humanities classes in my education, and by far the most brilliant teacher I had was my high school Shakespeare teacher, who also happened to coach hockey. So I wouldn't put all coaches in one basket. I think we had to be a little more careful and judge the man just on his actions.
I'm just concerned about the level of expertise and professional background in making decisions about people's health care and the availability of that health care through the Pentagon, right? So this is military policy. This is policy around the families and people who are enlisted, who volunteer to serve this country, and then to have this kind of political debate about what kind of health care they can have while they're serving this country, where they are stationed, without the ability to choose where they're stationed or where they bring their families necessarily, is you know, problematic in my mind. If you want to have a conversation about you know, what those policies are and do it in a productive and respectful way and bring your, you know, personal opinions to that, that's one thing. But to pressure the Pentagon by holding up these key appointments based on what appears to be a fundamental lack of understanding of the need to have access to health care is, in my opinion, inappropriate.
I agree with most of what you say, but I would just challenge everyone. Let's not conflate his lack of understanding and his disagreement on policy with whatever it is he did before he was in the Senate.
Nah, I would say, like, get all coaches out of Congress, including Jim Jordan. I don't see a good role model of coaches who have done great in politics for the country.
Well, I'm not gonna offend
with
Jim
Mark
Jordan
on this.
But let's be careful.
I mean, I agree with Mark on this in terms
you're nice.
Of well, no, I no. It's not being nice or not nice. I think it's just judging people by their broadly saying that all coaches are not capable, right? I mean, he wasn't a coach, but I think of Bill Bradley, a great basketball player.
He was a coach.
I'm sure he coached at some point somewhere, maybe somebody's little league or something, but brilliant, right? He was brilliant. But anyway, but I do think, and this is, you know, this is deep, wonky stuff, but the other fact is that certainly this is a policy debate because there is a disagreement in the country over this issue. And it is a policy debate that it's appropriate to have. But there's a place to have it, and that's in the legislative process. But Mitch McConnell and the Republicans do not want to have to vote on this issue through the National Defense Authorization Act. But that's where, you know, you hold hearings, you have a discussion, you understand the implications of it, and you vote up or down. But they don't want to do that because that's not a safe vote for Republicans too many of its Republicans to take, just like the House doesn't want to take that vote. And so instead, they create a problem with military readiness. But the Democrat, Schumer, said, said, let's have at it. Let's have the vote. Let's have a debate, a policy debate where it belongs, which is in the legislative process.
Panel at WAMC.org is the email address listeners may use to join the conversation. We got this letter from V, who says, thank you for the enlightening discussion. However, some light needs to be shed on the important considerations for the need of these procedures because of higher incident rates of miscarriages and other issues necessitating a DNC or other procedure. It has been hypothesized that exposure to chemicals, PFOA, burn pits, and other situations on military bases is part of the issue. We also heard from Leslie, who says, the issue of military appointments is far more complicated than the Democrats could have done this all along.
Right.
The rule about short emails will not allow me to explain it to Rosemary, but I suggest she research more before spouting off about it. How do you take that note?
Spicy.
Well, but no matter what they are, I still take the view that Schumer should have said, get your cots out, and we're going to pound through these. And by the way, what I think the thing he shouldn't have done was tell me that my national security is being threatened and do nothing.
Yes.
That's a horrible position to be taking. And frankly, it's a construct. I mean, he could have said we're inconveniencing military families and this doesn't help our readiness. But it was, you know, he made it sound as if, well, if this continues, the Russians are just going to push the big red button and we're all done. I mean, they were claiming the sky was falling and it wasn't.
Yeah, and so did all the military leaders who wrote letters and went on television. They manufactured a crisis.
No, that doesn't mean, by the way, that disadvantaging...
He created a crisis by not allowing, as has been done for a long time, these positions to be filled in regular order.
He dramatized a policy disagreement. That's what he did. And the Democrats allowed him to turn it into
The heat problem here is Tuberville.
We agree on that.
Actually,
I'm not defending
Tuberville. He dramatized it, and then the Democrats amplified it and didn't do anything to fix it.
True.
I mean, that's what we just saw happen.
Yep.
And then the Democrats said, oh, you know, there is this little thing we can do for some of them. Well, let's get at it then, kids.
Mm-hmm. Charles wrote in and says, I just have to say that Rosemary is right. The Democrats are weak following the rules while the Republicans walk all over them. Senator Schumer should have woken up and brought the confirmations to a full vote weeks ago. Love the show, Miss Allen. Panel at WAMC.org. The email address to join the panel. Our panelists today are investigative reporter and visiting professor at UAlbany, Rosemary Armeo, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rankle, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman. It is time for a break. Joe will be back with you momentarily. But actually,
Sarah escapes.
I'm trying to see if I'm looking. Okay, so behind the scenes narration. I'm looking into the other studio to see if he's done. It does look like he is done. So I will throw to a break. Thank you all, as always, for participating, for your expertise. Please don't lay hands on each other in my absence. And enjoy the rest of the show. Panel at WAMC.org. And you are listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
I can't think of a thing that hasn't been shot through with pain, like a nightingale sung in the dead of the night.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm back. Thank you very much to Sarah LaDuc for filling in while I... Ken Casey says hi, by the way.
No. Did you ask him what he thought about Tuberville?
I didn't, because I know he'd probably go on for about 45 minutes. I think he could give you a run for your money, Teresa.
I don't know him, so.
It's good morning. Welcome, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we welcome your letters. All right. So let's go to a new topic, because it seems like you are ready to go to a new topic. So let's do that. And I'm glad to hear everything worked out while I was away. We go to... Rupert Murdoch is stepping down.
Yeah, just announced that this morning.
As leader of Fox's parent company.
Not unexpected. He's like 100 years old.
Yeah.
Only in government do you stay that long.
He's 92 years old.
Like, and I said, almost 100.
And, yeah, but, you know.
And he's got two sons he's been raising in the business for decades. It's time. He's got what? He's on his sixth wife.
But Succession.
He's busy. I know, Succession. That's what you're thinking.
But in Succession, not what happened.
Yeah, I was going to say, doesn't he die while he's still
Yeah, there? That's right. Very much while everyone is thinking about Succession. That's, but Lachlan Murdoch would obviously be the... Yeah, okay.
Yes.
All right. So just catching up on that. So let's go to the story in Canada, which we touched on. Well, we didn't touch on. We jumped in on yesterday's program, but obviously much more to discuss. Biden caught between allies as Canada accuses India of assassination. President Biden has prioritized bolstering partnerships over full-throated advocacy for democracy among American allies. A day after promising to defend democracy, President Biden brought up India and Saudi Arabia on Wednesday during a round of meetings at the United Nations, not to raise concerns about repression by either, but to hail them for helping establish a new economic corridor. He said, "I think it's a big deal. Perhaps no two countries reflect the difficult and delicate trade-offs in Mr. Biden's foreign policy at the moment more than India and Saudi Arabia. He has made it a priority to court both nations as part of his effort to counter Russia and China, even as India has been backsliding in its democracy and Saudi Arabia never had one to begin with." The news of the week illustrated just how acute that tension really is. India's government was accused of orchestrating the assassination of a political opponent on Canadian soil. That from the New York Times, an article written by Peter Baker, who was our guest on the show on Monday.
Wow.
Mark, let's begin with you.
Well, first of all, Joe, I'd like to say that Colin Powell called and said we better check that Trudeau is correct in his accusations before everybody turns the planet upside down with respect to this. But let's assume that the allegations are true. It's clear that, you know, Modi thought that he could join the adult table of extrajudicial killings outside of his country, just like the U.S., Russia, Israel, and so many other countries have done. So let's all be clear. This isn't, frankly, unprecedented. And when we feel justified, we do it. Now, Modi's justifications are at best weak. You know, he's curtailed many freedoms, including notably freedom of the press, freedom of speech, some political freedoms. That democracy, it is a democracy in Israel, but I'm sorry, in India, but it's becoming ever less liberal and ever more controlled by Modi. Clearly, the U.S. needs to work in concert with Canada and other countries. The one clear thing is here, I think the West has been a bit duped by India recently. I think there was an assumption that we worked upon a basis of shared values. I think it's clear that we work with India on a basis of shared transactional interests.
Absolutely.
I do think it's clear you need to punish them for doing it, even though it's something we do. I talk to my son about that construct all the time. And you've got to be careful about how you respond. He did this to play to a Hindu nationalist crowd back home. What you need to do is something expensive to him, but very technical and hard to understand, so it can't be a rallying cry back in India. So something like, you know, throw him out of a payment settlement system that nobody can explain in less than 10 minutes, so it's not something he can make a quick banner of and get a lot of political
hay out of.
Yeah. And then, look, you've got to look. This is a you brought up Saudi Arabia. Look, it's a big bad world. We share values that we believe will prevail over time. But in the meantime, we have to be practical about how we interact with this world. We can't do what Biden did, which is he wrote a check about making Saudi Arabia a pariah forever. And he couldn't cash that check now that oil's nearing $100 again. You've got to be practical when you sanction these folks and do something that's, you know, reasonable, but allows you then to continue on. And you always should show up and talk. I mean, if you know, you can't be duped as Nixon and his folks were by the China-like people, where while you're talking all the time, they're raising an army that's going to then impinge on your interests. But what you can do is talk while you're trying to keep these regimes that you don't necessarily agree with in check.
I think that's pretty brilliant. I feel like the United States for some time has lacked an overarching foreign policy. You're right. We used to say, okay, we're governing and basing our foreign policy on values. That's never actually been true. We looked hypocritical. Now it's like openly violated. And the world is changing. The world order is changing. And the United States has conflicting interests. You are right. We need to be friends with Saudi Arabia and with India because we need them. And yet they do horrible things that are completely opposed to everything that we allegedly stand for. So what can we do about that? I would throw Hungary into that, too. Another place that a government got in allegedly by democratic means but is becoming increasingly illiberal and controlled, authoritarian. Philippines, same thing. There's a number of – I could take a world map and point them out everywhere. So how do we deal with them? There's nothing coherent. Osama bin Laden still has not been punished for killing a journalist, cutting up his body. That's just horrendous. And on top of that, we don't know how to treat our friends either. Trump really complicated that a lot. Canada is an absolute ally, our biggest trading partner, according to the newest statistics, our closest neighbor, and they have asked for our support. Why would we not give it? It is really what's in India that supersedes that. And I'm not saying, as in most political situations, you have to pick one or the other. You come up with something in between that makes everyone happy. It's called diplomacy. Our State Department has been ripped apart under Trump. I don't think it's still back in full force. And we're seeing the effects of that every single day.
Nick?
Yeah, I don't think that we haven't been supportive. First off, I just want to note, this is the second time in the show that I was like 100% in agreement with Mark. So, put that on the calendar, I guess. But I just want to
respond.
It means
you get your own vase of flowers next time.
Oh, is that how that happens? They're very pretty, if y'all don't know. They're dahlias. They're gorgeous. This particular article chose to highlight the supportive response towards India and Saudi Arabia and has this sort of isolationist undertone to it. But the bigger conversation, I think Biden very much was in support of Canada and conducting an investigation and concluding, what happened and finding out, what actually occurred without jumping to conclusions and without damaging trade relations and diplomatic relations with countries that we've been, had this diplomatic relationship with since the 40s. Like, I don't think you have to do one or the other. And I do think that Biden did both.
I have to correct something. I said Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, you did.
Obviously, he's not the head of. Sorry, I'm just, obviously I know that. Sorry.
No worries. Okay, Teresa.
I don't have a deep understanding of, except for what I do understand is that the global order is changing right now. It always does.
Yes.
But we are right now in a period of pretty extensive, complicated flux. I mean, today in China, Assad from Syria is in China today. And India is looking in both directions. They're looking to Russia, they're looking to China, they're looking to us. These are very delicate needles to thread. I think the U.S. does have serious interests in India as a market, as a technology partner, but just because where they sit in the region of the world. So I do think, while there's no doubt that Canada is one of our closest allies, I don't know if I heard you right, Rosemary, in saying, what's our interest in India? I wasn't clear if I understood you to say that you weren't sure about our interest in India.
No. I mean, balancing it against our interest in Canada, which is enormous.
Right. But I think we have different but deeply important interests in India.
Right.
I think this is a very, very delicate issue. And I think with Saudi Arabia, you saw in the Trump administration the deep embrace of Saudi Arabia, first country that the former president went to after elected, first foreign trip, which was highly irregular. And also his family, obviously, there was a lot of issues there with their financial interests in Saudi Arabia. And I think the U.S. needs to have an interest in Saudi Arabia, but also a check on them because of the way they treat women and the rest of the country. I just think I don't think I'm being very coherent in the sense of, I think these are really, really complex issues, and President Biden has to steer through them, and it's a tough way to go.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. We'll welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
Don't you worry, child. Don't hold no stress. Don't let nothing steal your smile. This world's a mess. Today could be the last you know.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And we're having side discussions, so thank you for putting up with that as well. We welcome your input, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We've been talking about Canada accusing India of assassination and what this means for Biden and other allies, for President Biden, for the United States and other allies. So who would also like to get in on this? We left off with Teresa.
I went.
Okay.
I can, just a couple of points I'd like to fill up. And I saw this, I forget which European publication it was, talking about sort of how we should deal with these despots. But look, you know, we always have to realize that we have to balance what's desirable and what's possible in these. We have to never stake out a moral position you can't sustain. And Biden's learned his lesson with Saudi Arabia with respect to that. There's also an issue is, you know, the West assumes that the rest need us more than we need them. That's no longer the case. India's a great example of that. So we got to be a little bit careful. It's great. We should always, you know, sanction wrongdoers, but you have to be careful about how you do it, and make sure that you're doing it to sort of make a point about the future, and make it expensive for them to misbehave. It's kind of like hockey, but you also, once they're in the penalty box and they've served their time, you got to get on with your relationship with these folks. And again, you got to be careful. You can't be duped like Kissinger and Nixon were in China. But while you keep a wary eye on these folks, it's always good to talk.
Yeah, but trashing President Biden for pushing back on Saudi Arabia, I mean, he needed to push back on Saudi Arabia. The previous president did not. And it was important that he do that. And he's continuing to talk. But when he talks, he acknowledges, you know, the where the values conflict or lack of values conflict. But I don't think he should be bashed for pushing back on Saudi Arabia.
Oh, I
they needed to be pushed back.
It's a nuanced criticism. I mean, if I may, he
just
Biden,
flat out, you know,
Biden and
denigrated
it is when
him.
He was running. Well, when he was running for office, he said he was going to make Saudi Arabia a pariah. And then he decided at $100 per barrel of oil, maybe we should fist bump them. So I look. So what
no,
we,
I don't think that, that's
yeah, a little nuance. So what we should
that's
do?
That's not true, and I don't think it's all over oil either. It's yes. Positioning in the Middle East.
Oh,
and with,
by the way, so the article that we read in preparation for this also mentioned that it's been revealed that we're in negotiations with Saudi Arabia and Israel to facilitate a peace pact, I guess we'll call it a peace pact, right? Anyone in this room who doesn't think that Biden is going to hold that promise out during the election so that gas prices don't run away, please raise your hand, because I have bridges to sell to you. I mean, he's realized his vulnerability and he's covering it now. He could also very justifiably say that facilitating peace between those two is very important, and on the right terms, we should do it. But there's a practical element to what's going on, and we should all be clear-eyed about it, frankly. And by the way, the other thing I'd like to say is
he is being clear-eyed about it, and you're trashing him for that.
No. I'm just saying,
I mean, I know there's a constant, you know, Biden's terrible theme here, but
no.
I mean, he's the president; he has to make hard choices. I don't like the fact that he's negotiating with Saudi Arabia, interacting with him, but he has to. He's the president; it's essential.
Oh, I love that he's interacting with Saudi Arabia, because I think we need to be adults.
results in foreign policy. I think he's doing the right thing.
But I also appreciate the fact that he's been pushing back on them.
You got to find a way to do both. I think I'm particularly relying on one comment he made while he was campaigning and using that as an example of going too far. And I think it's a perfect example of what we should do with India. I mean, we should call a 2-minute penalty. Now, the bad news is if you're in a transactional relationship with a country like India, they're going to push back. So in order to express your view of what values should be in the world, you're going to pay a cost. We should be willing to pay that cost. And when the penalty's over, we should go back and interact with them on the terms that they want to interact with us on it. And unfortunately, with respect to India, despite the West's imputing their motives, it's not on shared values. It's on shared transactional interests. And that's how we should conduct ourselves. But I want to say one thing about the peace process in the Middle East, which I think is informative of how we should think about when Ukraine ultimately gets solved. Why is the U.S. involved in a peace process between Israel and Saudi Arabia? Well, it's because we have lots of gifts, like we did when Israel and Egypt came to a peace process, that we're going to give to the participants, particularly to Saudi Arabia, to help facilitate the peace process. So when Moldova stands up and says, I'm going to solve Ukraine and Russia, the answer is no, you're not. We'll know that the peace process is serious when someone who's got gifts that both sides wants and is willing to give those gifts gets involved in that process. Just a little geopolitics.
That's very, yes, real politic, exactly.
Let's see. We have letters. The problem with them is they're really long. I apparently have not admonished our writers in a while for keeping the comments very, very brief.
Hit the highlights.
There is a yes, I know. There's just a fine line between a comment and a manifesto.
I want to hear a random sentence from the middle with no context at all.
Actually, I can do that, I think. Yeah. Okay, here we go. This from Barbara. We've lived through many years now of criticism leveled at American media for the difficulty they're having in covering the age of Trump. Most of the criticism comes from folks who skew Democratic. Well, actually, most criticism comes from folks who skew pro-democracy. Right. As Republicans in too many places are going full-on fascism, erosion of law. Lately, I've noticed ferocious defensiveness in many pundit types who are turning their anger towards Democrats. I believe it's because they're becoming quite tender from all of the criticism, which is coming from folks who skew pro-Democrat and pro-democracy. That from Barbara. Anyone on that? All right. Then we go to Denise. This fist bump thing drives me crazy. It was COVID. This is what is being done, fist bumps. Didn't do it because he approves of him. What was he supposed to do, kick him? That from Denise from Hudson.
Denise, you and I are in league. He should deal with the Saudi Arabians, but pariah and fist bump are inconsistent, which is the original point I made.
But it's too sweeping. I mean, anyway, go ahead.
Richard says more critical geopolitical events are causing the world to turn a blind eye while Trudeau is to stand firm against India without further jeopardizing trade, despite intelligence briefings, not a supportive word from Biden, Macron, or Sunak. Real politics is ugly and requires moral gymnastics as the slippery slope as we attempt to defend democracy. All right, let's move on to other topics on this morning's program. We remind you, you can be a part by going to panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I want to briefly talk about the migrant situation amid new border strains. Biden extends legal status to 470,000 Venezuelans. The Biden administration said Wednesday it will offer temporary legal status to more than 470,000 Venezuelan migrants in the United States, announcing the move as U.S. authorities struggle to contend with a border influx in Texas that has stretched holding capacity to the brink. Biden officials told reporters that Venezuelans who had entered the U.S. by July 31st would be eligible for temporary protected status, a designation that will shield them from deportation and speed up their ability to obtain U.S. work permits. permits. Nick.
Yeah, I think this is it's a good positive move because it allows both space to be freed up in detention space, but also moves towards allowing work permits, which is critical to releasing the valve on the economic pressures that the that the migrant crisis is causing in some parts of the country. So I do applaud it. I will note that applying for these temporary visas is really difficult still, and that there are just not enough resources in the community to assist the applicants with their application processes. That's particularly true in Albany. We need more assistance and more support for immigration attorneys and immigration experts who can help at least fill out the paperwork here in the Albany area. I know Albany Law School is doing a lot of work on that. The Legal Project is doing a lot of work on that. LASNY does not have a program. Does not have a program largely because of some of our federal restrictions, but more support to helping these migrants actually apply and fill out those papers would be tremendous.
Teresa.
I think that this is, as I was listening to Governor Hochul last night doing an interview on this after it was announced, I thought it was intriguing. First of all, clearly she worked hard on this and others. I thought it was intriguing where she acknowledged some of the complexities that these decisions bring, because on the one hand, you want to help the people and you want to help the states and we need the workers. But on the other hand, you don't want to put a "we're open" sign and have people not come through the regular process. But to me, this just is a reminder of the much bigger picture, which is Congress needs to stop complaining about the border and start getting to work on a comprehensive immigration reform package that they can come to a decision on and pass. And then they need to properly fund the pipeline so that it can be administered properly. Right. Yet at the same time, we have the members of the House, holding up the appropriations process and proposing deep, deep cuts. They scream about the border. They go down to the border. They trash the Democrats on the border issue. Yet they don't come to a consensus on a comprehensive immigration policy to set the rules that will work. And they don't fund the, and you can speak to this better than I can, but all of the judges you need and the processing you need to deal with this in regular and appropriately.
Mark Whitman.
I thought this was a temporary Band-Aid. I thought it's probably right for Biden to reach into the medicine cabinet and pull this out. But let's remember, it's only an 18-month stay, so this isn't permanent. So as Teresa says, look, I think it is interesting to note that I forget the number of immigrants that have been bused to New York City. Is it, whatever the number is, Eric Adams claims that it's going to be the ruin of the city. What he really meant, by the way, was the ruin of his political career, because the city has been built on immigrants. So, Eric, he got two things confused there. But, and aside from all the human pain this has caused, I do think the whole process has shown us something. There are the pipeline in terms of not only judges, but in terms of having places to stay and having filling people into jobs, sort of the pipeline of getting people from, if you will, the border and integrated into our society is not unlimited in its capacity. We need to figure out what the pipeline is on a nationwide basis, fund it accordingly, and then go back to the spigot at the border and adjust the rules accordingly. Now, some people are going to say, well, but that's going to change the meaning of political asylum and who can come in. That's right, it will. If you look back at political asylum back in World War II, around World War II, when it was first formalized in the United States, it meant the government of some other nation was literally coming after you, and you needed our protection. And I think we'd all agree that something between that and where we are now is what we need to do. But there is a system here that we can
sort of build. I also think, as Rosemary, not to steal her thunder, but a couple days ago, she said, look, but the Republicans and the Democrats, at least to sort of at the working level, need to be calling each other up and figuring out what we can do.
Right. Yeah. It's all very good to talk about what Congress should do and how we need an integrated policy. Obviously, we do. But it isn't going to happen. I mean, look at it realistically. We are years away from having a body that will be functional enough, if ever, to do that. And so instead, why aren't the governors, why aren't the mayors of the cities most affected talking together? Why isn't the National Association of Governors sitting down and say, what are we going to do about this? And get around the rules. I'm sure that there are like alternative rules or what I would call loopholes to get around that. Does the paperwork required really need as much as we have now? Isn't there some way to get around it? And if you can make an exception for Venezuelans, who richly deserve it, by the way, I'm so glad we did that, why not for the Dreamers? Why not end the complete uncertainty in which they are living their lives now, which is utterly cruel in my thinking? And there are ways to do that. I mean, Biden could pass executive action, for example, to do away with that waiting period for work permits. It would be challenged, no question. But in the meantime, you've got 6 months before there's a final decision and you're getting moving people out of the pipeline.
Unless
yes,
there's an
temporary
injunction.
But there'd be an injunction.
Of course. And maybe it wouldn't go through because we don't know what happens with our courts now. It's completely one day you do get the injunction, the other day you don't. But we're not even trying it. We're not even trying to go below the level. We're just saying, oh, it's impossible. That's why I'm feeling very frustrated by constraining rules. We are honoring rules more than people's lives.
But isn't there a bigger picture problem here in that with the climate issue, you're going to have a growing and growing number of climate migrants, right?
Yes.
And as the water access to water shifts and that kind of thing, you have the situation in Ukraine with the breadbasket. You're going to have food issues because if you can't get food out of Ukraine, then that's the food that goes to many countries in Africa and other places. You're going to have food shortages. That's so they're more economic migrants. You have to look at the issues don't start at the border. The issues start back in the countries. And again, what is our broader policy to try to prevent the influx? And then what are the clear rules? And how do we not put a sign that says open for everybody that causes these big influxes that you can't handle?
We don't disagree. It is complicated. And what I'm saying is not going to solve any of that. We do need a Congress that will sit down and give us a rational reform. We do need an administration that works with the states and the municipalities for an integrated system. We do need a climate policy because that's coming. But we're not getting it. So in the interim, I'm thinking of that family that's sitting in a hotel in Rotterdam right now without food, without any hope of what they're going to do in the next few weeks. We can solve that by doing stopgap measures. That's what's required.
Right, but that has to come from the federal level, and
it's
being solved by the principal of the high school and elementary schools who are saying we're going to be welcoming.
It
right?
is, and
it's
and being the soccer solved. Game that they arranged between immigrants.
Exactly,
in Albany.
It's being solved by all the volunteers who are helping with the paperwork, but that's a Band-Aid, and they can't change the rules of the complex paperwork. The governors who say, they have proposals, the national, the...
You have to.
Sorry.
Joe Biden could do it. Joe Biden could do an executive order like he's going to do right now on us.
Yes. I thank you all very much for being with us. I appreciate it. We'll be back with more show right after this.